In the New York Herald, November 26, year 1911, there is an account of the hanging of three men. They died for the murder of Sir Edmund William Godfrey, husband, father, pharmacist, and all-around gentleman resident of Greenberry Hill, London. He was murdered by three vagrants whose motive was simple robbery. They were identified as Joseph Green, Stanley Berry, and Daniel Hill. Green, Berry, Hill. And I would like to think this was only a matter of chance.
Everybody, welcome to Generation Lost, the show about movies featuring Bryn
and Jeremy.
And we are deep into Paul Thomas Anderson month featuring The Dark Council. We are a little late. Sorry. Hello.
Sorry, we're back. My son was sick.
And Jeremy thinks that's an appropriate reason to not do an episode.
Sometimes a kid is sick and you got to take care of him.
Is he okay?
Yeah, he's fine. He's totally fine
now. He's fucking fine. Though he shook it off, right? They're little kids. They can just get over it.
Yep.
Yeah, so it is Paul Thomas Anderson month. We have done exactly one, which was Boogie Nights, which we both love. And now we are going to do two more movies that we have. Jeremy has seen neither of these until today.
That's correct.
Wow, amazing. I have so many questions. We are doing double features to catch up. We were not going to talk about what else we watch, which is very funny because I'm still in plane mode. So I'm trying to keep what I remember about all these movies from what now 3 weeks ago in my head.
Well, I couldn't be happier, Bryn, because I was going to have to talk for 15 minutes about Aladdin.
That's okay. Well, I'm very curious about how Aladdin holds up, but it doesn't matter. We
not
have to get
today.
Right into it's 1 minute in and already our feature presentation. Movies and popcorn.
Movies, popcorn.
I thought you like lost the button or something.
No, I was just trying different timing.
Okay.
Yeah, so today we are talking about first Paul Thomas Anderson's third feature film called Magnolia, starring so many people. It came out in 1999, which it's so crazy how many movies came out in 1999 that are really important and big by such great directors.
Well, let's go through some of these names because, I mean, there's some on here that aren't big names, but there's a lot of big ones. We got Tom Cruise as a very interesting addition here. We've got, of course, Philip Seymour Hoffman, John C. Reilly, Julianne Moore, William H. Macy, some classic PTA collaborators. We got Melinda Dillon, Jeremy Blackman, Philip Baker Hall, fucking Ricky Jay. A lot of people in this. Alfred Molina makes another appearance.
Alfred Molina. Such a star-studded cast. But it's funny because this is kind of before any of them are like super famous. It's kind of a lot of, like, let's see. Who are actually the huge names? We've got Julianne
Moore.
Tom Cruise.
I mean, Tom Cruise is the
big obviously,
name.
No. It's Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is the top build, but he's not, though. Like, when the movie came out, it was just like a bunch of names on the poster. Tom Cruise was not even, there was no top billing. It was a weird movie and people were like, whoa, Tom Cruise is in this. So that was sort of the big one. But besides that, it's Julianne Moore and maybe Philip Baker Hall. But it's not like he was a huge name, I guess. Mm-hmm. Jason Robards is a pretty big name, but like in the in the 40s, you know, he wasn't like, he's not like a huge star at the time.
No, no, the draw here is Tom Cruise for sure.
Right. So, this is a movie that is about, I don't know, 10 different people or something. And they're little vignettes of stories and how they're all interconnected. And they're all basically connected, mostly by a television show, a game show.
Called What Do Kids Know?
What Do Kids Know? That one of the dying men is produced. And then you've also got the host.
And in the universe of the movie, What Do Kids Know is like a massive show. It's like hugely successful. It's, I would imagine, like the cultural cachet of it is similar to at the time Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Like, it's just a big show that is, like, must-watch.
Or, like, $64,000 Pyramid or Jeopardy or something.
Yeah, I was thinking, though, of, like, I mean, like, Millionaire and then Weakest Link were two back-to-back, like, mega-hit game shows that were, like, I mean, people watched them every week, you know? Like, people, like, it brought people back to game shows, whereas like Jeopardy has always had a pretty consistent audience, but that audience is Jeopardy people, you know. Like Millionaire had
that's
like
true.
Broad pop appeal.
Yeah, and that's kind of
the sense you get from this, because like William H. Macy's character is a former contestant on What Do Kids Know, and he's able to parlay that into like jobs, because people are like, wow, the boy genius who had a big run on What Do Kids Know, people are going to come into the shop to see him, you know. Like that's kind of where it sits culturally, right? And all these stories interconnect with each other. We've got a current contestant on the show. We've got a former contestant on the show. We've got the host of the show, the producer of the show, and then a couple of people who are kind of like on the fringes of it who are connected in other ways, right? Looking at this, there's like a chart.
There is a
on
chart
on the Wikipedia page that I'm having some trouble with, because it's
you don't remember the names.
I don't remember the names exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
So I'll tell you how it goes. So the guy who produced the show is Earl, and he's the dying guy in the bed who's
the
being
really dying guy
who's being taken care of by Phil.
Because there's two dying guys, by the way.
Oh yeah, yeah. The really dying guy.
The really, really dying guy.
Right. The really, really dying guy is Earl, and he's being taken care of by Phil, who is the nurse, who's played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. And then Frank is TJ Mackey, or whatever his name is. Frank Mackey. He's the Tom Cruise character. That's his son. And Julianne Moore is Linda. She's married to Earl. She was sort of, you find out later that she is married to him for the money. She's a gold digger, but then she realizes that she really loves him, and that's causing her a lot of emotional distress as he's dying, because she wasn't prepared to actually watch this guy die. And then Dixon is the little black boy who raps to the cop, Jim.
That's right.
And then
Jim dates Claudia, who is a cocaine addict, who is the daughter of
Jimmy,
who is the host of the show.
Yes. And Jim also meets Donnie, who was a young child contestant who is now all grown up, and he's gay and sad. And then there's also the contestants on the current show, who are not really listed here. There's also Stanley, the little kid. And that's everybody. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 is sort of the main thrust, but you get a ton more. You get Stanley's dad, you get like lots of different little characters in each of their orbits. You get like William H. Macy has a crush on some bartender, and then there's like the funny gay guy at the gay bar that they're at, and
oh, I love him.
That's a good scene. I think is that Dick Jennings? Anyway,
what a good bit. What a classic character type. The like weirdly cryptic old queen at a bar is like one of my favorite tropes.
Oh, he's
in media.
So good. Yeah, he's great. So yeah, the movie is sort of, you're introduced to all of these people with zero context, and then as the movie goes on, you're sort of it becomes illuminated what their relationship to all of them are. And if you look at the chart on the Wikipedia, which is very helpful, thank you.
It is actually very helpful. Whoever made that, thank you.
It's very helpful. especially for this purpose of talking about it. if you can look, like, Dixon is connected to Linda and Jim through one event, but like not really connected to them. Mm-hmm. They just like meet once. Has nothing to do with the show. Phil is connected to Linda and Earl because he's taking care of them, but like he's in this like situation, but he's not connected to the show. So it's like they're all sort of like, some of them are deeply interconnected and some of them are sort of on the fringes.
Mm-hmm.
But it becomes illuminated the way in which they are all connected at some point. That's sort of the through line of the movie, which is that like everyone is sort of kind of all in this milieu of emotions in life, and then there's a big climax where one thing happens that all affects them all at the same time.
So I was going to say, in a different kind of movie, in a different version of this movie, these stories would interconnect in ways that kind of lead to a specific outcome where like everybody has to come together, or there's some sort of a thing that will happen where like it snaps into place, like why we've been following all of these connected characters. And what's very interesting in this movie is that that never happens, and that's not the point at all. And in fact, like, the reason why we're following all these characters isn't really important at all.
No.
You know, it's it's kind of just like, at the end of it, you're just like, okay, so it's really, it's more just like a, you know, you're seeing it more as a way of filtering than anything else. Like, it's just kind of, it's as if the whole world exists in the universe of this movie, and PTA has kind of decided, I'm going to narrow it down to this group just for convenience sake. Otherwise, this movie would be 20 hours.
Yeah. And just before we get into like the details, I guess, or what we did and didn't like about the movie, what do you think of it?
I liked it a lot. I did not like it as much as Boogie Nights or, sure, as I will explain later, Punch Drunk Love.
Sure.
I think, you know, it's a little bit weaker of a movie just for how long it is. It's a little bit boring at times. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of scenes where I'm just like, just fucking get it over with. Just move it along, you know. There's a musical number in the middle that, while it is an interesting and fun creative choice, functionally speaking, I'm just sitting there like, come on. Can we be done? Can we move it along? So I think it drags a little bit more than the other PTAs that I have experienced. However, it's awesome, and it's supported by some incredible performances, and I really love the thing that happens that we'll discuss later.
Yeah, so this movie for me,
which interestingly, another connection, by the way, this was in the bonus episode, we were talking about a trailer that shows two people who are in Fargo. This is another connection to Fargo. In the first season of Fargo, you remember, it rains frogs.
Yeah, fish.
Fish, whatever. Same culture, or same
phenomenon.
Weather phenomenon, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so this movie, for me, was a high school movie where I was like getting real into movies. Mm-hmm. Punch Drunk Love was about to come out when I saw this. I had it on DVD. Boogie Nights in this movie. I had Boogie Nights in this on DVD hidden under my bed. Mm-hmm. Because I wasn't allowed. I had a big old shoebox of stuff I wasn't allowed to watch under my bed. This movie was an adult's movie that I thought was really powerful and really cool and really interesting and philosophical and all this cool stuff. Made me feel smart and cool for watching.
Sure.
As I watched it, as I grew up, in retrospect, like the more I think about it, the more it feels like a movie about being an adult written by almost a child.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that this movie deals with really heavy things, but in a pretty like clunky way.
Yeah.
That he doesn't give enough time with the characters to make us really feel like really attached or enmeshed in what they're going through. To care that much. Like, it's all sort of intellectualized. It's all sort of like, because I think that it is really important, and I don't want to sound callous here, but I do think it's like there's a thing that happens when you're in your like late teens, early 20s, where you start to become obsessed with or like really impressed with like the butterfly effect and cause and effect and like sure. the idea that like your consciousness is not simply the yourself and like what yourself is influenced by all these other things. And like, I think PTA like honestly was just like still kind of in awe and wanted to express like how interesting that concept is.
Yeah.
But like once you're in your 30s, it's sort of like, yeah, I know.
Right.
But what? Then what? And
but
it's like,
what? Yeah.
And that's kind of how I felt watching this movie, where it's like a movie that is sort of childish in its ambitions. But he's also one of the probably the most talented, amazing directors working.
Yes.
So it's still a joy to watch, and that his work with actors is incredible. And
that's what I was gonna say is like you don't get this many A+ performances in your movies without being pretty fucking good with actors, and you don't. Now three movies in a row, Boogie Nights, Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love, find somebody who nobody takes seriously in a particular way and put them into a role where everybody looks at it and says, how didn't I see that before?
Oh, shit, it's like that kind of person. Oh,
like,
fuck.
Tom Cruise as the pickup artist speaker character is such an inspired casting decision that it makes John C. Reilly as the aging porn star look like a joke, you know,
yeah.
like, and it makes Mark Wahlberg, you know, as this diamond in the rough that you found, like these things look hilariously minuscule in comparison to Tom Cruise as Andrew Tate. And then we'll get to it in the next one, and then to have realized who and what Adam Sandler is and to crystallize it so perfectly in Punch Drunk Love then makes Tom Cruise as the pickup artist guy look stupid. Like he's incredible at working with actors, identifying their strengths and yeah. drawing them out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's way more impressive than, you know, screenwriting, you know.
Well, it's like it's also not bad. Like there's nothing bad here.
Right.
Like most of the stuff that is in here is pretty successful. It's just like to me, so I think that my biggest issue with Magnolia is the intention, like the exact idea of doing this and trying to do it this way of just being like, what if we gave the epic treatment? Like this is a quote from PTA, or you know, somewhat of a quote. He wanted to give small moments in life an epic treatment.
Sure.
To give things that don't normally get that treatment.
Mm-hmm.
The same as like, you know, 10 commandments or some huge battle or whatever. Like,
right.
Just like, what is it like to find out X about your husband or watch your father die or something? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like these small moments of humanity, this like grand thing. And I think, while it's an interesting experiment, I think it ends up making those things seem less important,
mm-hmm.
like because of how well his like formal aspects of filmmaking and acting are, it ends up feeling a little melodramatic in a negative way to me. Where it does, like there's movies that I've seen that are about small horrific things that people do to each other, or you know, small love that is really important to you, that is done in a much closer, like tender way, that is much more affecting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of bombast makes it feel a little chintzy.
Yes. I think that the score plays a big role in this. I'm not crazy about the score of this movie at all. I think a lot of people kind of really raise it up as a big part of what makes the movie work, and it didn't do it for me. It felt it reminded me a lot of the Hugh Jackman movie we watched, the death one, his wife is dying and he's in three different timelines.
Oh, Fountain
reminded me a lot of Fountain, where
it
feels very repetitive and overbearing, and it adds extra weight to everything, sure, but at sometimes you're just like is this just the music doing this, or is it the movie, you know? I also think that this movie suffers a little bit from too many ideas. I feel bad because we said this about him in the last movie, but William H. Macy doesn't need to be in this movie.
He's fun and
interesting, and I like his little story, but he could have been cut with absolutely no no negative repercussions to the movie. Dixon also could go. I heard somewhere that that Dixon's story was actually supposed to be more significant, and we were supposed to learn about who the worm is, and it was supposed to be either his father or Jim's father. I'm not totally sure. But like, there was supposed to be another character who was the worm, and it was supposed to have some sort of a like major impact on the Jim storyline, and that got cut. And so I kind of just have to say, like, why didn't you just cut Dixon altogether? Doesn't really do much for us.
Yeah, this movie. It's funny. My boyfriend described it as like being mostly a climax. And I think because of that, it kind of becomes a little bit tiresome.
Yes.
You're like, okay, it's constantly crescendoing. You're kind of just like, well, if there's no dynamics and it's all crescendo, then it all kind of feels like flat, even though it's at a high level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a problem with the structure of it, where it just feels like there's too many stories that are all supposed to be climaxing at the same point. So you get like a full hour of movie where everyone's like tense and like doing something. But then while he tries to make everyone's climax simultaneously, some of the people's issues are not as important or tense. Like tying Jim and Claudia's date as a climax when you've got like Frank Mackey like dealing with like hiding his past and you know Julianne Moore dealing with the death of her husband all at the same time makes the date seem really superfluous, and it's like, why am I seeing this? I'm not feeling the same kind of energy here. I think it's a really interesting swing here, but I just don't believe it works.
I don't think it all comes together exactly. It reminds me of a quilt, you know. It just kind of like it's a bunch of pieces sewn together, and sure they all are holding together nicely, but you kind of look at it and you're like, that's a lot of color.
Yeah, do I really want this?
I really want this? Is this going to work in any room of my house?
Yeah, that's why people put quilts on the wall.
Yes.
Like they're like, I'm not going to use this. This is like some sort of Rothko that I have now. I think it's very similar to that, where it's like I can hold it away and be like, wow, cool project you did, PGA.
Yeah, lots of craftsmanship here.
And you know, there are specific scenes that are really great. Like, specific pieces of the movie, like, really work for me. And it's not like I said, it's not like any of the other ones don't work. It just ends up feeling a little uneven.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I have to be clear here that, like, the formal aspects of the movie, the filming and the editing and the acting, like, are 10 out of 10s. Like, he's still incredible, even when
it's
he's making
literally
a
just nothing
really
but 10s. I don't think there's anybody in this movie who I'm like, what are you even doing here? I guess Dixon is probably the weakest performance, but he's a kid. I mean, what are you going to do?
Sure. I also will say I agree with you about the music and not only the score, but I remember watching this in high school and being like having an outsized expectation of how many adults listened to or knew who Amy Mann was. and just being like, wait, no one knows who this is. Like, this is just some some pet fan. And it really reminds me of a thing you do that younger directors do, is just like get their favorite artist to be in their movie because they were writing to it or whatever. And it's like, that can be really successful. Sometimes it can be kind of cheesy, especially when this is sort of like Starbucks music, is how I describe it. Like, I don't really think that these scenes for me where they're all singing Give Up really work. Like,
no.
They've aged pretty bad. That song has aged. Putting a new song at the climax of your movie right before the actual climax where all the frogs happen is a huge swing, but it's like, that song sounds like I would have heard it in Starbucks in 1998. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
And I don't feel whatever I'm supposed to be feeling from it. And I probably did feel from it in high school, you know, when I saw it.
Right. Can I tell you a little factoid I learned about this?
Tell me.
So I mentioned on the bonus episode this week, patreon.com/generationloss. I mentioned that I was listening to the episode of You Made It Weird with Pete Holmes, where he interviews John C. Reilly. And Pete Holmes is a huge PTA freak, and he talks to John C. Reilly about like every PTA thing that he can. And one of the things that they talk about is this movie. And what I learned is that the genesis of this movie is that PTA, John C. Reilly, and Philip Seymour Hoffman were all just like best friends. They were best friends back then, hung out every day. And apparently, John C. Reilly at some point shaved his beard that he had for some role, and he left a mustache behind. And the other two are like, dude, you look like a fucking cop. This is crazy. You look like a real cop. Let's go get you a cop costume and you can like really look like a cop. And I guess they were all watching Cops at the time, and they were like obsessed with like the filmic, you know, particulars of Cops. And so they started making their own cops, and PTA would drive around with John C. Reilly in the car. And you know how like Cops would always start with them in the car, just kind of like talking about being a cop before they get to the call. So they would just like drive around, and John C. Reilly would just improvise all these monologues as a cop. And that's literally like, that's where the idea for this movie came from, was that they just loved so much these monologues that John C. Reilly was improvising, that that's all that's in here for him. Like, is these things that he monologue that he improvised. He just like wrote down and did them for the movie.
I lost my gun today. I'm a fucker.
Yeah. That was improvised. That was just something that he made up one time. And yeah, very interesting little factoid there about this. I think it's interesting because John C. Reilly, similarly to a couple other characters, is a little bit superfluous to the movie. He's not a huge influence on anything that happens, but I like him a lot. He's so good in this.
No, yeah, he's fantastic. I mean, he's a national treasure, and I think he should be in everything. I love him so much. I think it's... But yeah, I mean, his parts are like kind of a different movie, but it's like, I think it breaks it up nicely. Like, that's one of the things I like about the movie, is that like, if you like a part a little more than others, like it's going to come back and you're going to be able to like to take a break from the really heavy, like that's when it does work, especially in the beginning of them. I feel like the first half, the first hour and a half of the movie, like works really well, in like, oh, we're doing this, and then it's a kind of confusing and you're still trying to like figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think my least favorite thing about the structure of the movie is that the beginning of the movie has these three examples of
just weird things that happened that were kind of coincidental.
Yeah. Like forward, you won't believe this email. Like, stuff that your like grandparents would send you, a like interesting brain teaser, Twilight Zone-esque stories, like almost like jokes, but that aren't supposed to be funny. And it has them, three of them, and they're all pretty successful in that sense, like in terms of being little like, oh, isn't that funny? Isn't that kind of interesting that that would have happened or whatever? And I feel like that's supposed to prime you to be looking for that kind of influence in the movie as the structure. And I just don't think that there is one of those in this movie.
No, there's no coincidences really. I mean, it's not like these kind of like odd things where like John C. Reilly loses his gun and then like that's the one that the TV producer picks up and finds, and then he like starts thinking
about
suicide.
That's what I'm saying. Like that I wish that he had actually made a thing where it's like this one thing happens and like it affects every other story.
Yeah, and I kind of actually I feel the opposite way, where I wish that he cut the coincidence shit and just got straight into the movie, because I think actually what is kind of cool about this movie for me is that there are no coincidences. There are no like, ooh, ain't it neat how people interact with each other and stories intersect and whatever. There's not a whole lot of that. I like actually that it's like, it kind of sets it up in such a way where that's what you expect. You 100% are like, this is going to be like a, you know, a butterfly flaps its wings and a tsunami happens in Japan. Like it, and then like it sets it up that way. You get through 90% of the movie and you're like, okay, here we go. We're getting to where it's all going to come together. And then frogs rain from the sky. And it's like, no, actually, shit just happens sometimes.
Sometimes random.
You know, and it's like really... I said in my text to you when Nico was sick, you know, we make plans and God laughs. I mean, that's really what the movie's about, right? Is it's like you have all these big expectations. You have all these big ideas about what's happening in your life and like where it's all going and what it all means and whatever. And then sometimes you just get cancer and die. You know, sometimes you get struck by lightning and you lose your boy geniusness, you know, and sometimes frogs just rain from the fucking sky and it just like ruins whatever your plan was for the night.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you're right, actually. And I think that might actually completely change my mind. Maybe it is actually, maybe it's good that the consequences or the coincidences are there at the beginning to be
to really sell it. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't like that opening. I don't like the opening narration right at the end where he's just like, this can't be something that happens. Like, I feel like it's a little overwrought even now. But no, I think that's an interesting point that it's setting you up to expect some sort of domino falling. And then it's like, actually, it's like sometimes people are just having trouble altogether. And like, that's just how life is.
That's a good way to put it.
But one thing I don't like is, I guess, the half-hearted way that it is sort of the frogs, where it's like Philip Baker Hall is like putting a gun to his head and then the frog knocks it out of his hand. I don't like that very much. Like, either go full bore, like the frogs matter a lot, or they don't.
Right. Yeah.
I don't really know.
Although I don't know. I mean, it's like, I mean, that was his plan. His plan was to kill himself. He had this big idea about how like he's going to free himself from the torture of knowing that he molested his daughter and, you know, the torture of dying of cancer and stuff by shooting himself. And instead he, I think, burns to death in a house fire. Right. That's the idea.
Wait, what? Who dies?
I think of Philip Baker Hall. Right. Because he shoots it into the wiring of the house and you see it spark and set a fire. And I don't think we check in on him again. So I assume he just dies. He like gets knocked out by a frog that falls on his head and then he dies in the house fire.
Is that what happens?
And then William H. Macy is like going to rob his, he like robs his old employer because he wants to get money to get braces, because he thinks that if he has braces, he'll have something to relate to the bartender.
Yeah,
on.
That's what's
but
such
then he just like
story
knocks
line.
All his teeth out. And I mean, that one's a little bit too Twilight Zone-y for me. That's a little bit too like, oh, we had all the time. We had time now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I like
oh,
it
yeah,
as
I guess that is what happens.
Yeah, he sets a fire. I don't know
so
if
he
he's
dies?
Supposed to have died in it.
We don't check. You're right. We don't check in on him.
We don't check in on him again.
So he's just he does kill himself, but
he
in
does
a
kill himself,
way.
But in a much more painful and much much worse way.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. It's an interesting little movie. I liked it. I don't think I liked it a lot. I think I liked it, though.
Yeah. I think it's a really interesting little stone on the path that he's on, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, he makes this really great, sort of meaningless, but like otherwise really fantastic, you know, aesthetic piece. And then he's like, well, let me try to say something. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, well, I'm 26. Maybe
yeah,
I don't
do
have much
know?
To say.
Yeah.
And so he's still like knows he's so talented, very believes in himself, very much believes in himself, and then like takes some big swings and I think is successful in some places and fails in other places. And I think it's a really interesting movie and has a lot of great performances and is definitely worth watching.
I 100% recommend it. Definitely getting a recommend from me.
It's a good movie. It's like the very best. Like, you know those movies that are like New Year's Day or like Valentine's Day or whatever, where it's like, or Love Actually. It's like the very best version of that movie possible.
Yes.
But it's still not like, it's still not like a 10 for me. Like, I think this is a, it's a interesting, a very interesting swing with a lot of great hits and a couple of big misses. So I think it's a good movie.
Good movie.
Good movie. Check it out. And we have to go right into talking about Paul Thomas Anderson's next movie right now.
Movies, popcorn.
There it is. There's
there
that Tom Cruise.
Is.
That's Frank Mackey, everybody. Frank
That's
Mackey.
That's the man.
The famous pickup artist, Frank Mackey. Yeah, so this next movie is that he does is Punch Drunk Love. Comes out in 2002, starring Adam Sandler, which I can't express to you how strange it was when this trailer dropped in what was it, probably 2001, right after September 11th. It was just like, I was such a big fan of Paul Thomas Anderson at the time.
There were probably nerds who were comparing the two in severity. They probably were saying first 9/11 and now this.
Maybe.
This year couldn't get any worse.
In my memory, the tenor online was soy facing. Was excitement and sort of like bafflement of like, is it going to be serious? Is it going to be funny? Is P.T.A. Anderson doing a funny movie that we're all going to like and laugh at? Or is it going to be, can Adam Sandler pull it off? I can't wait to see it. Was the tenor of at the time that I remember. But it also, you have to remember, not very many people cared about this. Like, this was a really, really small group of internet people who were excited about a movie that basically didn't come out anywhere. Like, this wasn't a big movie. This was a small movie that, according to Wikipedia, bombed, not making quite back its budget, distributed by Sony Pictures. Really small 90-minute romantic comedy, I guess. And you hadn't seen this, right?
Hadn't seen this. I want to say right off the bat, I had a very interesting experience with this movie where I was watching it and, first of all, I loved it. Loved it a lot.
Okay, great.
Think I might like it better than Boogie Nights. I'm not totally sure. I loved it a whole hell of a lot. And as I'm watching it, I started to get this really strange, like, feeling of voyeurism where I felt like I was peering into a man's love of another man's work. And like the way that Paul Thomas Anderson like understood Adam Sandler.
Sure.
And understood his strengths. And again, I mean, this is, I've said this about him in every one of these now, where like he is able to like define so perfectly a type of guy and then find somebody for that role that you'd never thought of for that role. And then after he does it, you can't possibly unsee what you've seen.
Uh-huh.
I just like, I was getting this really strange feeling of like, I can't believe like how well PTA knows Adam Sandler. And then I read on the Wikipedia page, that's pretty much exactly what the genesis of this movie was that PTA loved Adam Sandler comedies and was just
like obsessed
like, with Adam Sandler
he's
comedies.
The funniest guy of all time.
And that he saw in it this like this really magnificent thing that you don't think of with Adam Sandler necessarily, but like once it's pointed out to you, you can't really think of anything else, is this like simmering rage beneath the surface of his idiocy
anger.
That like it peaks up and you can see him control it and like try to push it back down. But it's always like once you see it, it's just beneath the surface and you know it could come at any time.
Yeah.
And I just was like, I really was like, I was just really having an interesting time, like, seeing this, like, love that that was clearly brewing between director and actor, where, like, I started to think of it as, like, this isn't a, like, this is a romantic comedy, obviously, about Adam Sandler and Emily Watson, but it's also a love story about Adam Sandler and Paul Thomas Anderson. And yeah. I think it's very interesting to see them all back to back like this, and to have picked out in all three of them this talent of Anderson's to, like, find an actor for a role that's so perfect. And that this one, he seems to have kind of realized that that's his talent, and said, instead of putting all this other window dressing around it where I'm, like, telling a big story, where I'm, like, worshiping the texture of 70s porn, or, like, talking about, like, the ways that small moments can be huge in a life, you know, he's just like, what if I'm just doing this one thing that I'm really fucking good at?
Yeah.
And I just identify this guy and I make something perfect for him.
Well, yeah, and it's funny because, I mean, doing this series on the show, I don't think I knew that about him either, in the sense that when we were reading about Boogie Nights, he said, like, all I do is I find an actor I want to write for.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I was like, oh, that's a fun way to, like, think about movies or whatever. But I didn't realize how intensely it's like, when he says I want to write for them, he wants to write for them because he sees something in them that they haven't actually been able to be given the chance to do. Mm-hmm. By another movie, where it's like, oh, they're perfect at acting this way, and they do it sometimes a little bit, but, like, I want to really explore that, this, like, emotion or this, like, kind of guy. And, like, with, we didn't really talk about with Tom Cruise as Mackie, like, he saw in Tom Cruise this, like, extreme confidence and charisma,
mm-hmm.
and charm, like, overlaying this, like, brittle,
yeah,
thin skin of, like, oh, but if you push on it a little bit, he, like, isn't able to hold it together. And he's, when you see, like, in, like, you can think of all the movies that he's done this in, like, in A Few Good Men and Days of Thunder, and, like, all the movies that he's, like, famous for, like, he's this charming, smiling, happy guy, but then, like, as soon as something happens, he's just, like, freaking out and screaming and, like, mm-hmm. crying and stuff. And it's like, how do I make that more human and, like, less high stakes, and making him a pickup artist of, like, oh, he's a guy who's selling this, like, lie to people. And then, like, we find out his lie. It's so great. So I just think, like, him you're absolutely correct. Like, him realizing he can do that for people, for actors. And he talks about in the Wikipedia that he was watching this. Did you watch that? That particular Denise show moment where his dad calls. He's like, you're embarrassing the family. He's like, he does do that thing. He's like, oh, dad, why are you doing this? It's funny. And then there is, like, this moment where it turns, like, an extra rage turns on. He's
yeah.
like, you don't know me. You don't fucking know what's going on in my life. And he describes it as, like, his irises turning black and, like,
yeah.
rolling back in his head.
I always think of the one that always stands out to me in his career is in The Wedding Singer, when
yeah.
he's when what's her name, the woman who stood him up at the altar, Linda, when Linda comes back to talk to him about it, and they're having this kind of, like, reasonable conversation where she's, like, outlining what her fears of it are and, like, how he's changed since they met.
Marry a wedding singer?
Yeah.
I'm, like, never gonna leave Ridgefield.
Yeah. And he's, you know, at the beginning he's, like, keeping it together. He's like, you know, this really would have been pretty helpful to me yesterday. And then and then there's one where he just says, like, again, things that would have been helpful to me yesterday. His ability to just, like, open the box and just let the fucking dragons out, you know?
Yeah. And then it's funny.
And then, like, close it again. He's the only person who's able to, like, close the Pandora's box again, you know?
Yes. And it's just, like, this, like, little, like bursts of, like, lava coming out and steams comes out and then closes mm-hmm. back up. He's like, I'm sorry. And that's to make a character that's so perfectly designed around that is so funny and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I like, so the movie is about this guy. He is a, we haven't actually gotten to what the story is about. It kind of doesn't matter, but he's a guy who owns a company that makes
novelty
items. Yeah. Or just other items like toilet plungers and shit. He's just like a distributor for like novelty shit that goes to like 99 cent stores or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he has seven sisters who are all awful to him.
Yeah.
And it's, I like how not on the nose this is. Like, it's so surreal that he has like all these like Jewish women like like just constantly picking at him and calling him gay and like.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not over the, like, there's like a, I think a worse director would have like close ups of their face, you know, and like,
mm-hmm.
you know, have like him just getting overwhelmed. But it's like very calmly and coolly shot of just like, this is the situation he's in.
Yeah, no, and it's done really, really masterfully with blocking, which I'm always much more interested in a director who can get blocking right than I am in a director who can get shot selection right. I love how his sisters are like fucking buzzards. They're just like constantly like surrounding him, pushing him into corners, just like moving him around spaces is incredible. And and even when they're not there, he's like moving to different phones in the office to talk to them as he's like interrupting his meeting to be like, yes, I'm coming to the party. No, I don't know if I'm going to come to the party. Yes, I'm coming to the party.
I feel like this movie like might get accusations of like misogyny or like incel type of movie, but I feel like the idea is not to be like, oh, women are bad to him, because it's also ignoring all the men who are bad to him in the movie too. It's just like his main thing is that he's like lonely and doesn't have anyone to talk to and is surrounded by people who are sort of jerks to him all of the time and like don't care about him, and that's done by having like, you know, just feeling alienated by having seven sisters and being the eighth child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that's particularly sexist or misogynist. It's just like a way of showing a surrealist sort of like alienation. So he like asks a guy, and also like, I don't know, it's 2002, like male loneliness is like a really under talked about issue at the time.
Yeah, and absolutely. Like, and it's not just his sisters. I mean, like, he shows his isolation in a lot of different ways. Like, he works exclusively with Hispanic guys. You see him like during his lunch break, like sitting on this beat up old like van back seat in the alley with a bunch of Mexican guys who are clearly just speaking Spanish to each other and not talking to him. When he goes to his sister's birthday party, all the brothers-in-law are there, and they're all just completely a different type of guy from him. And you can tell just from the moment he shakes hands with one of them that you're like, oh, they're not like friendly. He's not homies with them. Like,
no.
They're all homies with each other. They're all kind of chatting with each other, having a great time at the party.
Yeah.
He's the odd man out everywhere.
I hate that watching this movie, like white extinction, like ideas. I'm like, okay, it's not about that. They're not trying to reference those things. They're not like having any white grievance or like male grievance here. Their PTA is just showing like that he doesn't have any friends.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have much to relate to with people. Anyway, so he goes to his sister's birthday party. They're all really mean to him and really bully him all the time. And they're all making fun of him for this thing that he did when he was a kid, which is break a sliding glass door out of anger with a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
And so he does it again, kicks all the sliding glass doors in again, and then they're all mad at him. I like how that like never resolves. They just like, they don't care about him. They're like,
yeah,
they get,
I think,
mad.
They mention it one more time on a phone call where one of them is just like, hey, I wanted to talk to you about that thing that happened last night. Like, are you gonna pay for the windows or
and
something?
He's like, thank you, bye. He hangs up. Yeah, and he just kind of. It's a movie about a guy trying to figure out like how to get out of the situation he's in.
Mm-hmm.
And then also there's a girl named Lena who has a crush on him And she's also maybe a little crazy and like alienated and lonely. We don't get to see much of her life, unfortunately. But she has a busy job that she travels for all the time, and he's got a plan to get 1 million frequent flyer miles, which at the time was a lot more. You know, that's based on a real thing.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, no, there's all sorts of like these little
specific guy did this exact scheme, and it was like in the news.
Oh, interesting.
And he got 1.2 million frequent flyer miles from Healthy Choice pudding cups.
Hilarious.
It's the exact plan. And it's very funny that he did that.
I used to be pretty keyed in on that sort of stuff. I had a group of friends when I was in college who we all kind of like kept track of these like little exploits. You'd find them on like various like tiny web forums of scam artists. And I definitely like did a few like smaller scale versions of this thing.
You've talked about them on the show before.
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, like, I obviously this sang to me. And I was like, hell yes, brother, get those fucking puddings. Take your employee. Go get more. It broke my heart when it didn't completely work right away.
In real life, he hired a group of people from the Salvation Army because it wasn't a coupon that doubled them. It was if you did it in May, in like the year of May 1998 or the month, if you did it in May, they were doubled. So he had to like, he spent $800 more dollars hiring people from the Salvation Army to help him cut out each individual UPC and then send them in, and it worked. So he got 1.2 million frequent flyer miles. Yes, and it works out for Barry too. It all kind of works out. He gets embroiled. He calls a phone sex line, which he doesn't seem to know what to do with, but ends up jerking off. And then the next day they try to the woman who's he has phone sex with tries to blackmail him into giving her money, but it's like a real stupid, like, don't actually know how to blackmail people. She's like, I'll tell your girlfriend. He's like, I don't actually have a girlfriend. And she's like, fuck.
Yeah, and he cancels his credit card, and she's like, wait, you weren't supposed to do that.
Yeah. And so she they send guys from Utah to go like shake him down, which they successfully get $500 off of him, but then he ends up confronting them again. And
it happens a little bit later, but we'll get to that. So he meets Lena. They go on a date. On the date, she like mentions something, or something comes up that like sets him off, and he like goes to the bathroom and just like fucking destroys it. And then, like, they get kicked out of the restaurant, and they go back to her apartment, and she's like, he's leaving. He kisses her on the cheek, and he leaves. And then she's like, I really wanted to kiss you. And he's like, okay. And he like goes back up, and there's a great sequence of him trying to find her apartment again in this like giant nondescript LA apartment building. She goes on vacation to Hawaii, and he flies out there. He takes his first ever airplane to go out to Hawaii to see her. Just really cute, fun little sets here of just the way this man's mind works. Just fascinating stuff. I love how he gets to Hawaii and says to the taxi driver, take me where all the hotels and beaches are. And then he realizes that's not going to work.
It's Hawaii.
And he's like on this payphone with her, or he's on the payphone to his sister trying to get her number so he can find her. And there's this like beautiful parade happening behind him that he's just completely closed off from because he's like so focused in on trying to find Lena. So they meet up, they fuck, they love each other now. And it changes him completely. He still has this simmering rage, but now he's able to wield it. One of the interesting things in the beginning part of the movie is that he does have this like violence within him that is like constantly coming out, but he's not able to channel it into anything valuable to him at all. Like he you see him like wreck rooms and like go crazy breaking shit, but then like when he gets shook down by these scam artists, he's like a pussy, and he's like cowering from them. He runs away. So then they get back to LA and they're like going to park at his apartment and they like crash into his car and he just like turns into a superhero for a second. He turns into like Blade for a second and he like beats the fuck out of them with a crowbar and he's like spinning it around all confidently and stuff.
Yeah, he's all of a sudden like a John Wick type guy.
Yeah. And then she goes to the hospital because she hurt her head in the car accident. He drives to Utah to confront Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's in the movie, and he's the king scam artist. And I don't know necessarily what this does for the movie except get Philip Seymour Hoffman in there and get him also to do fun screaming stuff.
It is
I'm
really
not
weird.
Complaining about it, you know.
Like he makes a 10 and a half hour drive in like a cut.
Yeah,
like do we even see his car before that? Like,
no, it's hilariously disorienting because he literally like is like, I gotta take care of this. Cut to he's in Utah.
Yeah,
he does it, and then cut to he's back at the warehouse and he's like, I just got back from Utah. Like, I think it's on purpose supposed to be a little fantastical at that point.
Yeah, I guess so. When I remember watching this as a kid and I did not know he was in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I never made the connection until watching it, like, literally this time. I've seen this movie, like, 5 times. I thought it was just some other place in L.A. that he, like, went and confronted
him. Well, because she says on the phone that she's in L.A., so you're just like, I believe her.
Yeah. I mean, watching it this time, I was like, oh, yeah. But you only get, like, three scenes of Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Mm-hmm.
And he's great, obviously. He steals the show, actually. I mean, like, his 3 scenes are fantastic. But yeah. It's like, I don't know. It is really weird. Like, why is he in Utah? Why isn't he just in, like, I don't know, like a couple hours outside of LA or something? Like, they could have done anything.
I mean, I think it's whimsical. I think it's to add to the kind of fantastical side of the romance element, right? Where, like, he flies out to Hawaii on a whim and then comes back. And then, like, you know, now he's just, like, lighter than air. He is, like, you know, he's a changed man. The line that he says to Philip Seymour Hoffman is, like, I have love in my life, and it's made me more powerful than you could possibly imagine. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It's incredible. And that's the point, right, is that, like, now, like, because he's in love, because he has the strength of love behind him, like, the drive to Utah means nothing to him, and it means nothing to us as the audience. Like, what would we have gained from seeing it? Nothing.
Yeah,
except no. To convey that it's a far way that he went. But we already got that. He flew to Hawaii. We know he goes a far way. So now it's just like, whatever. He fucking goes and deals with it.
Yeah. He's getting his groove. It's about a guy who hates himself, kind of just realizing, like, I'm going to take something that I want. I'm going to become a little more confident and, like, one lady being like, it's a romantic comedy. Like, mm-hmm. Structurally, it's a romantic comedy. And I think it's interesting that Paul Thomas Anderson was like, I'm going to make a romantic comedy, whatever that means for me. And I'm going to put Adam Sandler in it. And, like, Wedding Singer style.
Yeah.
And it's great.
It's awesome. This movie fucking rocks. I think in talking about it now, I have decided this is number one. This is shooting to the top of the PTA list.
No way.
Yep. This is number
better
one.
Better than what? Better than There Will Be Blood?
I mean, I have to rewatch. I mean, we're watching There Will Be Blood next, so we'll yes. see. I mean, I have seen that many times. I do love that movie, but I haven't seen it recently enough. So pending with an asterisk, I'm saying Punch Drunk Love, number one. There Will Be Blood, number two. Boogie Nights, number three. And
okay.
Magnolia, number four.
Those are all you've seen?
That's all I've seen.
Okay. I still like, I go back and forth on whether I think it's There'll Be Blood one, and then maybe Inherent Vice two for me, and then The Master three.
And The Master is our other one, right?
Yeah, that's the last one we're doing. And then so next it'll be There'll Be Blood and then The Master. So we will take stock of what we like after this. But that's the show, I guess. We talked about it all. I mean, did you have anything more to say about Punch Drunk Love? Except it's real fun and good and
it fucking rocks,
it's,
guys.
It's funny. We did. I don't know if we really mentioned this, but it's still a comedy. Like,
yeah,
it is,
it's very funny.
It's
Adam Sandler is incredible.
It's a much darker comedy than a romantic comedy usually would be. Like, it's about somebody who's very uncomfortable with himself and with everyone else around them. And, you know, but I think the love stuff like kind of works. It's funny. Yeah.
I think it's an interesting companion to his other big dramatic movie in Uncut Gems. I was going to watch that again just as a comparison piece. But I think it's interesting that like the two times that he's been a big dramatic actor are in these like super like tense, you know, stress factory movies. But I think it's interesting that I think PTA got way more out of him than the Safdie brothers did.
Oh, sure.
I think like, Adam I think Sandler... his performance in Uncut Gems is great, but I think the movie is better than he is a great actor in it. I think this one is like, it's the Adam Sandler show. This one is all just like, I can't believe how good he is. I can't believe how well observed this role is. Like, it's unbelievable.
Well, he's also had chances by the time Uncut Gems comes out to like have some serious roles. Like, mm-hmm. Spanglish is a kind of serious movie where he's not raging. He's not like freaking out and doing his thing. He's like just being a guy.
Mm-hmm.
Click has serious stuff. Rain Over Me has serious stuff.
Click has serious stuff.
Dude, Click is really sad.
Isn't Click about like a magical remote control?
That's correct. It's a really sad movie. I remember liking it in 2006. I'm sure it's not as good as that. I remember it, but I remember liking it quite a bit. But he's had funny people. Like, he had time to like be like, what am I like when I'm serious? And I feel like this is a movie that he's like entirely being sculpted by PTA to like get a really crazy performance. And I also wouldn't be surprised if the Safdie brothers aren't as good of character directors.
Yeah.
As PTA is. So, you know, it's a cool movie though. It's very good. I think it's a fun little tight 90 that he's Paul Thomas Anderson said. He
gotta
wanted
tell you,
to...
when I saw that it was 90 minutes, I did a chef's kiss. I said, "Wow, thank God, Magnolia is so long."
Oh boy, yeah. I mean, the rest of them are all very long.
It's very funny though to finish Magnolia and be like, "Okay, let's make a quick one.
Let's just do a nice." In and out there.
Nice breezy one, huh?
Yeah. All right. So that's Paul Thomas Anderson month, week 3. Sorry about the hiccup there. Sometimes you make plans and God laughs, as Jeremy says.
Oh, that's right.
As he's always saying. Thanks so much for listening. This has been Generation Loss. If you'd like to hear more of our show, next week we'll be doing... I've got to say, we would normally talk about this off camera, but I will be on tour next week. So hopefully we will be doing Fargo and another movie next Monday. But we're going to miss, I think, we're going to have to push back the next one, I think. So we'll figure out that schedule. But this whole month is going to be a little bit weird. So prepare for that.
And get ready for another weird month after that, because my daughter's going to be born in a couple of weeks.
Oh, my God. A baby girl. Yeah. So, you know, we're having life stuff over here on Generation Loss. Bear with us. Thank you very much. But we will continue to churn out the content for you. And if you'd like to buy a little more, you can go to patreon.com/generationloss. We are going to do a new TV show. No fucking chance is Fargo winning another 2 seasons.
No,
I'm not
chance.
Watching that.
I will not allow it.
I'm not even sure if we'll do a vote because I don't care. So we'll probably do, if you want to get in on and vote on that, go to the Sopranos tier. If you want to tell us what month we're going to do next month or the month after that, depending on how this is working, you can join the Dark Council. You can get a bonus episode every week. You can hang out with us in the Discord. All kinds of fun stuff. Follow us on Twitter at GenLostPod. Follow us individually from there. Remember, friends, if you want to hear email episodes, you have to email us. Our email is GenerationLostPod@gmail.com.
That's right.
Listen to Jeremy's other show, or watch Jeremy's other show on YouTube, Jeremy Thunder. Listen to my band, Stay Inside, my other show, BB Bledis. And until next time,
that's movies.
And all at once I knew it once, I knew he needed me. I wonder why I knew he needed me. It could be fantasy, oh, or maybe it's because he needs me, 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 he needs me. Like a diamond dance, I'll take a chance, I will, because he needs.